Good evening. James McCanny here with my Science Hour, and this is February 2nd, 2012. I hope you can hear me. I'm probably broadcasting this or transmitting from one of my worst positions in my history of doing this show, so if I break up or have a little bit of communication problems, just keep listening, and if I for some reason drop completely, just hang with me, and I should be back shortly. So at any rate, February 2nd, 2012, first of all, I want to announce a book sale. I posted this on my web page. Some of you have already seen this, and this is somewhat in a celebration. I just finished reprinting three of my books, the Planet X, Comets, and Earth Changes book, just came out of reprinting a couple weeks ago. Atlantis to Tesla, The Colburn Connection, just came out of reprinting a couple days ago. And, of course, the Calculate Primes book with three-hour DVD was reprinted. That finished about maybe a month, a little more than a month ago. So, anyway, the reprint costs, I, of course, do all of this myself. I don't have government people that help me out with my book publications, as do some of my detractors out there who get freebies, and they get free office service, they get free websites, NASA or other facilities support their publications, gee, all kinds of stuff. But I don't get any of that, and I don't want any of that. I never took any of it. I'm not associated with government programs. So I do all this myself. So all I'm saying is to kind of help build some what I need to pay off the bills for printing. I'm having a 2-for-1 sale. So I'll just make this quick. Most of my shows, I don't have any advertisements. I let my webpage do all the talking for me. But if you buy any book, DVD, or CD on my webpage, or any combination of those, any of the packages, etc., you will simply get 2-for-1. So if you ordered a book package, you will get two of each of the items in that book package or CD, book CD or DVD package, whatever. You will simply get two of them sent to you at no extra cost. So it's a 2-for-1 sale, and additionally, anybody who orders a total of $400 or more, and that $400 can include any of the products, including the water filter products. So if your total, including water filter books, etc., is more than $400, then we will also send you a free Kato WRX 911 shortwave FM-AM radio, one of the little emergency radios. You'll get that for free if your total order is over $400. And that, as I said, the total $400 total can include anything. The 2-for-1 sale is just for books, CDs, and DVDs. So that's, I will say no more, and your purchases will help, as I said, offset the cost of printing those three books. And that's the price of success there, I guess, because the books continue to sell, and I must say my Planet X, Comets, and Earth Changes book is nearly a decade old and selling just as well now as it did when it first came out, because it gives a realistic picture of that topic, something that's so confused today, the topic of Planet X. So at any rate, okay, moving on. Now, for a number of weeks, I've wanted to play this video, and it's a video in which NASA talks about Comet Lovejoy. Comet Lovejoy is, of course, the comet I did a number of, quite a bit of time on my show, because Comet Lovejoy, first of all, was a major league big comet, but it was not seen until it was almost to the sun. And this is such a great example of a big comet. It comes in, gets all the way to the sun, and then is discovered at the very last minute by an astronomer in Australia, in southern Australia. And so that just gives you an inkling of how things this big, comets this big, can get into our solar system, get all the way to the sun, and nobody can see it. Well, why? It's coming from that southern region of the sky that is only visible late in the spring and only visible from points almost at the South Pole. So at any rate, and then this comet made it all the way into the sun. So anyway, Comet Lovejoy was very special in that it's a comet, a sun-grazing comet, but it's not just your average sun-grazing comet. It went through the solar atmosphere and came out the other side, and the nucleus was visible in the morning sky by observers on Earth. People just out on the street could see this comet in the morning sky, the nucleus of the comet, and NASA continues to claim that this comet nucleus was only 600 feet across, 200 meters. And so anyway, it is so absurd. It was so absurd. Anyway, listen to my previous shows for those details, but NASA came out with a video, and the video is so ridiculously nursery rhyme. I have it tonight, finally. I have conditions where I can play the voice, and it's like, okay, boys and girls, this is science at NASA, and everybody's supposed to sit down and listen to the experts at NASA. And, of course, there are still mysteries about this comet. Well, I won't continue to paraphrase this. I'll let you listen to yourself, but I want you to listen to the voice of this person. It's kind of like, okay, boys and girls, adults, grandmas and grandpas all around, let's all sit around the fireplace and the radio and listen to the NASA nursery rhyme. Okay, so anyway, without saying any more, I'm going to play this, and I hope you should hear it, and then I'll come back and make a few comments, and then I'll play the very end of the video, the last 30 seconds or so, where they say in 600 years NASA might figure this out. Anyway, so listen carefully. I'm going to play the video, and hopefully then we'll come back and talk about it.
Some comets like it hot. Presented by Science at NASA. Comets are icy and fragile. They spend most of their time orbiting through the dark outskirts of the solar system, safe from the withering depredations of intense sunlight. Their natural habitat is the deepest cold. Last November, amateur astronomer Terry Lovejoy discovered a different kind of comet. The icy fuzzball he spotted in the sky over his backyard observatory in Australia was heading almost directly for the sun. On December 16th, less than 3 weeks after he found it, Comet Lovejoy would swoop through the sun's atmosphere only 120,000 kilometers above the stellar surface. Astronomers would soon realize a startling fact. Comet Lovejoy likes it hot. Terry found a sun grazer, says Carl Badhams of the Naval Research Lab in Washington, D.C. It appeared to be as wide as two football fields, the biggest such comet in nearly 40 years. Sun-grazing comets aren't a new thing. In fact, the Orbiting Solar and Heliospheric Observatory, SOHO, watches one fall toward the sun and evaporate every few days. These frequent kamikaze comets are thought to be splinters of a giant comet that broke apart hundreds of years ago. Typically, they measure about 10 meters across, small, fragile, and easily vaporized by solar heat. Based on its orbit, Comet Lovejoy was surely a member of the same family, except it was 200 meters wide instead of the usual 10. Astronomers were eager to see the whopper disintegrate. There was little doubt that it would be destroyed. When December 16th came, however, Comet Lovejoy shocked us all, says Badhams. It survived, and even flourished. Images from NASA's Solar Dynamics Observatory showed the comet vaporizing furiously as it entered the sun's atmosphere, apparently on the verge of obliteration. Yet Comet Lovejoy was still intact when it emerged on the other side. The comet had lost its tail during the fiery transit, a temporary setback. Within hours, the tail grew back, bigger and brighter than before. It's fair to say we were dumbfounded, says Matthew Knight of the Lowell Observatory and the Johns Hopkins Applied Physics Lab. Comet Lovejoy must have been much bigger and tougher than we thought. Only a few days after it left the sun, the comet showed up in the morning skies of the southern hemisphere. Observers in Australia, South America, and New Zealand likened it to a searchlight beaming up from the east before dawn. The tail lined up parallel to the Milky Way, and for a few days made it seem that we lived in a double-decker galaxy. Astronauts on the International Space Station also witnessed the comet. ISS Commander Dan Burbeck, who has seen his share of wonders.
Okay, I'm going to cut in here for a minute and just make a few comments. You can listen to this whole video. It's about 4.5 minutes long, and I think there's about 1.5 minutes left here. But you can listen to this. It's called ScienceCast, Some Comets Like It Hot. Just do a Google search on that. It's science from NASA. But I want you to listen to the last few minutes here. And here we go. I'm going to bring it up to about, with about a minute to go here. So let's listen to the final, how NASA doesn't understand the mysteries, but maybe in 600 years they'll figure it out. I want you to listen to this part of it, the video, and I'll play the last about minute of this video now.
What caused Lovejoy to lose its tail inside the sun's atmosphere, and then regain it later? This is one of the biggest mysteries to me, says Badams. And then there is the ultimate existential puzzle. How did Comet Lovejoy survive it all? The comet that liked it hot is returning to the outer solar system, apparently still intact, leaving many mysteries behind. It'll be back in about 600 years, says Knight. Maybe we will have figured them out by then. To learn more about solar system mysteries, hot and cold, visit science.nasa.gov.
Okay, there you got the NASA commercial, too. Anyway, so bizarre. The ending I really love, where NASA might figure it out in 600 years. At the rate they're going, it might take longer. But at any rate, I wanted you to listen to that because it's so important, once again, for NASA to minimize the this issue of comets. That comets, they are these little fluffy. How many times could this guy say fluffy, little, you know, weak? I don't know all of the words used here to describe Comet Lovejoy. But then they say it was a whopping 600 feet across or 200 meters, which is absurd. Now, how could somebody on Earth see this nucleus? And you notice they admit, too, in the video, that it was hours later after coming out of the sun till it reformed the tail. So that hours period is when observers on Earth actually saw the nucleus, not the tail that we normally see, just the nucleus they saw with the naked eye next to the sun. Now, you're going to tell me that you could see a 600-foot-wide thing next to the sun at the distance of the sun with the naked eye through the atmosphere in the morning sky is so absurd, it's so beyond ridiculous that, well, and these scientists have to be in la-la land. But anyway, it's so important for NASA to continue to pound on this. Well, why? Because I've talked about this before, all the laundry list of reasons. Okay, I don't want to dwell on that the whole show. I want to get on to some extremely important topics here. First of all, stories about Monsanto. This week, Monsanto, I was told, bought a bee company, or a company that does makes poisons for bees. And what they want to do is specifically kill off the bees, the current crop of bees that exist in the world, and introduce a super bee that only pollinates the Monsanto Frankenstein plants. And so this seems to be a very backdoor way of killing off any kind of plant that is not owned and controlled by Monsanto. Okay, here's another one, however, and let me see if I can quick pull up this. Okay, this came in on an email. A group of organic seed growers and sustainable farmers are suing Monsanto. This is kind of a reverse whammy because for years Monsanto has been suing private farmers, farmers that grow organic food, and Monsanto claims that the pollen from organic farms is corrupting their hybrid seed crops, and they therefore sue these farmers out of existence because they don't want farmers to grow any kind of seed. They want an absolute domination of the seed market. And so at any rate, here's kind of a reverse whammy on Monsanto, and it's a landmark action, and of course it depends on some judges going with the organic food growers. So anyway, here it is on January 31st, family farmers, organic seed growers, and sustainable farm advocates will travel to New York City to take part in the first phase of the lawsuit filed to protect farmers from genetic trespass by Monsanto's genetically engineered seed, which contaminates organic and conventional farmer crops and opens them up to abusive lawsuit by the world's largest biotech seed and chemical corporation. Okay, so at any rate, this is a reverse lawsuit where the organic farmers are ganging up against Monsanto. Well, of course, Monsanto is a international corporation with no boundaries, agribusiness, and so we'll see where this goes. Usually the small people lose, the big corporations own the government, the court, phone calls are made behind the scenes. And so anyway, we'll see where that goes. But two stories on that. I talked last week or 2 weeks ago about Monsanto taking over the lake on the island of Molokai so they could grow corn seed there, a lake that was installed by citizens of the island to grow pineapples. Monsanto comes in, cuts a deal with the government, takes over ownership of the water in the lake built by the people of Molokai, it's an island in Hawaii, and then proceeds to use all of the water to grow its corn seed. Anyway, more on that. I'll try and keep track of that story for you. Here's a story that just came in this afternoon, and I want to say this is my own private investigation and has to be corroborated by second sources, third sources that have equipment to measure this. But in Los Angeles area this past week have reports from, as I say, a private source of my own, that the plutonium levels in Los Angeles are really off the map. This is, at the time I was attributing it to Fukushima, in the air, in the rain, and the seawater coming in across the Pacific Ocean into the Los Angeles area. And as I was talking with one of my contacts today, in comes the story of the leaking nuclear facility in the San Diego area of California. So this is just getting out of hand. The report that I have to make is my own private source, and as I say, this has to be confirmed by other sources, as I am not an official radiation detection or measuring facility. It's just my own personal private source. As I say, this has to be confirmed by other sources who are professionals in the field. But the plutonium levels in Los Angeles area are high. The information that I got from a medical doctor reviewing the results is that it will increase the cancer rates on the West Coast from 5 to 7 times the normal cancer rate. The report is that these specialists left the area because of the high amount of radiation. They said they were getting ill because of the levels of radiation. This is in the Los Angeles area. So I encourage journalists and scientists in that area to make their own duplicate measurements. The specific element that these people were measuring was plutonium. But then, as I said, I was attributing it to Fukushima, but now we're finding out that local nuclear facilities on the West Coast have been leaking. And this story just broke today, so I don't have a lot more information, a lot of details, other than that's what I was told. Also, this just in, that the Fukushima number 4 facility, the number 4 plant, is about ready to break open and start polluting. And they say if that one goes, it's going to be a mess. It's going to kill the Pacific Ocean. So thanks to our nuclear lobbyists in Congress and the nuclear industry, we have a real mess going on this planet. Just another notice here, this past week there was a major solar flare on January 27th, I understand, from looking at the pictures from the SOHO camera. These are X-rays and cosmic rays arriving at the same time with the SOHO solar satellite, the satellite that is orbiting the sun out away from Earth's own orbit. It sits in the what is called the L2 region. It's a gravitational well between Earth and the sun, and it sits there and examines the sun on a daily basis. And the X-rays, which are, of course, moving at the velocity of light, and the cosmic rays, which are relativistic near velocity of light protons coming out of the sun, hit the SOHO satellite at about the same time. And that's an effect that I discovered in 1999. If you have my Atlantis to Tesla, the Colburn Connection book, that's described in one of the appendices, where I was the first person to discover that effect with the SOHO satellite. It was published on my webpage, and then, of course, in true NASA style, they at first had no clue what was going on, and then afterwards tried to slide in and take credit for that. But at any rate, that happened again the other day, January 27th. But apart from that, solar activity is extremely low lately. Hardly any solar activity at all. Quick note on comet Girard C2009P1. It's a comet that is now, for amateurs, visible in the night sky. And, of course, information on where to see that and take pictures is on the Internet. Comet Girard, G-A-R-R-A-R-D-D. And I believe Girard is an amateur astronomer from Australia also. The designation is Girard C2009P1. And by the way, it's not a danger to Earth, but what is interesting is the photos very clearly show a sunward spike. You see the anti-tail, you see the regular fuzzy comet tail, and then to the sunward side, you see that very clearly a sunward spike. So keep an eye on that. You can see the pictures, the amateur pictures of that will be posted on the Internet. And I understand that that is a hyperbolic comet, which means it comes in and it leaves the solar system all in one passage. It's not a permanent member of our solar system. Here is a topic that I wanted to cover for a number of weeks, and I just didn't quite have the time. Noise in the sky, it's called. There are web pages now forming. There are YouTube videos forming. Clubs, etc. And there's, of course, with anything like this, there's a lot of hoax. There's a lot of people trying to get attention, people sending in false information. But there is some real evidence that then people are sending in real videos that are corroborated videos. So there are websites that are weeding this out. But the point is that in Europe and around the globe, there are noises coming from the sky, and people cannot explain them. They are trumpeting-type noises. So what I thought I would do tonight is, instead of trying to say there is a source and try and explain exactly what it is, I thought I would go through kind of a laundry list of topics that could possibly be the source of the noises in the sky. Also, I will mention the Windsor, Ontario, Detroit hum, as it is called, which has now regenerated. It has come back. It's in the news once again, up by Ottawa. And, of course, Ottawa is the location of the Tesla Tower that was built about 6 years ago. Remember when my Atlantis to Tesla, the Colburn Connection book came out? In that book, I described how Tesla trapped power. Within weeks after the release of that book, the Mill Ops boys set up an experiment in Canada outside of Ottawa. And it was heard, the low drumming noise of that Tesla tower was heard far and wide. And hours later, the New York East Coast blackout occurred. And so I describe in my shows around that time what happened. They set up a Tesla tower, and by the way, this is not something that takes years of construction. These towers can be put up in a overnight. In fact, they can actually be portable with the technology that's available today. So it's not like this was some kind of mega project to build a Tesla tower. And it could have easily been operated from an underground bunker, but this took place in west of Ottawa. But let me get back to the noises in the sky. What could possibly be causing the noises in the sky? Well, the first thing I came up with, and of course this is probably on many people's minds, somebody might be playing the harp. And of course the harp is a stringed instrument like a piano but plucked with the fingers. The harp also represents the name, the pseudonym, the mnemonic for the facility up in Alaska, the antenna array that can be directed, a directed antenna array that can be directed to any point in the world by bouncing radio frequency electromagnetic waves off of the ionosphere, and these can be focused on different parts of the world. So is somebody playing the harp? That's my first possibility. That's one of the possibilities. Number two possibility is someone is learning to pulsate the ionosphere with satellite lasers. In other words, there are various types of effects. Satellite lasers have been used to manipulate storms, to drag hurricanes around. And of course, a lot of people talk about HARP. Remember, HARP is very old technology. The newest technology is satellite lasers, to use satellite lasers to trigger energy sources. Now, imagine that you have a big pile of wood and you throw a little bit of gasoline on it. Well, the wood pile isn't going to burn by itself, even if you put gasoline on it. But you take a little teeny match and you toss it into that gasoline and the whole pile goes up. The match is the trigger. That's the thing that kicks it all off. Sitting there was a big pile of wood. It had energy stored in it, the carbon atoms and the carbon monoxide that was taken in by the plant and then oxygen given off builds the carbon chains in the wood that provide the energy. Okay, so basically you have stored energy, but that energy can't be released until that match strikes the gasoline, which starts the wood pile on fire and burns the whole wood pile. So you have a tremendous amount of stored energy, but it takes just the right little thing put in the right place, and so it is with satellite lasers. The ionosphere holds a tremendous amount of energy. It's a capacitor. It has the Earth's atmosphere as a dielectric, which is a very good insulator for a capacitor. Most capacitors in your radio, in your any type of capacitor, has a dielectric to increase its capacitance. So the Earth's atmosphere acts as a dielectric in a capacitor, holding the ionospheric charge away from ground. And so that's what gives you the vertical electric field of the Earth. So if you know how to creatively alter that, change it, discharge it, or discharge it locally, you can cause vibrations and other electrical effects in the atmosphere. So satellite pulsing is a way that you could, for example, create earthquakes. You could create volcanoes. You could make volcanoes go off where otherwise they would not. So you can do a number of things with satellite lasers, and in the wrong hands, they can be very dangerous. So that's number two. Now, natural causes. The ancients talked about the trumpets, the huge trumpeting noise in the sky. In the Colburn, they talk about this. The Colburn is very specific. When the large comets were in the sky and connected with Earth, and they saw the visual effects of the large comets in the sky connecting with Earth's upper atmosphere electrically, tremendous screeching, trumpeting sounds. That's where a lot of the references in the biblical references come from, of the trumpeting sound, and it deafened the people. These people came out of their deaf. There was probably a whole generation of people on Earth who were deaf after some of these events. So at any rate, electrical connections from outer space. How could that be happening now? Well, we're just moving away from a connection with Jupiter that was around for some time. So, but other types of electrical connections can be going on throughout the solar system. And I mean, we don't have instrumentation really to measure this. NASA, of course, has squandered our space existence with a bunch of spacecraft that aren't designed to measure electrical conditions in outer space because they don't believe it. They think magnetic fields simply exist out there, so they have fleets of spacecraft which look for magnetic effects. These are secondary effects, not understanding what how electrical effects work in outer space. I was on the Coast to Coast show one night. I was in a debate with a guy named David Morrison, one of the top NASA scientists dealing with comets, asteroids, and outer space. And he made the comment that space has to be electrically neutral because they've measured this with spacecraft. And it's the most ridiculous statement on the planet, and I know these scientists believe this, but how can you possibly measure voltage from a single point in space? It's impossible. That's not the way voltages work. And here's what happens. If a spacecraft enters a region where there's a charge relative to another point in space, that spacecraft adopts the local space charge in that region to be of the same voltage in the region. So if, let's say, you have an excess current of electrons coming from one direction and instead of protons, you have more electrons than protons. Well, what's going to happen? The spacecraft is going to charge up with electrons until no more electrons can come in, and it will repel electrons in equal numbers, and so finally you'll have the same number of protons arriving as electrons. And so the non-informed NASA scientist would say, we're seeing all the time, we always see the same number of electrons as protons, proving to us that space is electrically neutral. The only thing it proves is they have no idea what they're doing. They're building spacecraft that aren't meant or not they're not designed to test the electrical conditions in outer space, and thus they remain ignorant and try and pass this ignorant science on to the public. So at any rate, just mentioning this about the ancients, when a comet charges, for example, it is surrounded by a space sheath of both magnetic and electrical protection. And that's something that you can actually see. You can see around a comet nucleus, vast hydrogen clouds hovering in a globe around the nucleus for tens of or hundreds of thousands of miles in diameter. These are the space charge sheaths. So if you work your way inside that space charge sheath, now you become susceptible to discharges with that comet nucleus. If you are outside that space charge sheath, then you are not susceptible to discharges from that comet because you are shielded from it. But if you happen to get into the sunward path of that comet in between the sun and the comet nucleus, all of a sudden now you are in the solar discharge, in the electrical part of the solar discharge, and you can become electrically connected with that comet. Okay, so all of these things can happen in outer space. They're very complex issues, and if you want to learn more about this, read my books. All of my books talk about these kind of conditions, about electrical conditions in outer space and how they work their way down to Earth weather. One of the effects is the trumpeting, the high screeching electrical noise that can be generated in the atmosphere when the conditions are right in outer space. Could this be what people are talking about? Could this we be connecting with something out there electrically? And the answer is yes. The other thing about electrical connections is that they are localized. They are in a localized region of the upper atmosphere, so they tend to concentrate over a certain region. That's why these sounds are heard in certain regions. And, of course, what I get a kick out of is that politicians are being harassed by the public. They're demanding answers. And what does the stupid politician do? Well, he turns to his government agency, and the government agency turns to NASA, who doesn't know anything. It's filled with Tier 2 scientists that have no idea what's going on. So that's the public and the ignorant politicians. The cycle of ignorance continues. The bloodletting knowledge, equivalent of bloodletting, continues. The fairy tale science has no answers. So at any rate, I wanted to quick mention that, by the way, as I mentioned earlier, the Ottawa experiment that caused, and by the way, here I'll review this just for those that maybe missed that. This was many years ago. You can still hear me talking about this on my radio shows. They're probably about 6 years ago. Go back into the archives. All of the shows are archived on my webpage. But here is what happened with the Northeast power outage. It takes a lot of power to power up a Tesla tower. Here's how they work. You have an oscillation. A major league big Tesla tower has a frequency, a natural frequency, of about 40 cycles per second. That's enough to cause a very low humming noise, an electrical noise, and that noise will travel across the surface of the Earth for hundreds of miles, and you can hear that low drumming noise. It's a lot like a thing in Australia called a didgeridoo. A didgeridoo is a flat board with a string on the end, and you whirl the didgeridoo around in a circle, and you change the frequency of your spinning. And this is the way Aborigines in Australia communicated for centuries, possibly thousands of years, with a didgeridoo, because that low drumming sound would carry across the Australian outback for hundreds of miles. So they could communicate, and they knew what to listen for. The average person wouldn't know to listen for this, but they communicated with a didgeridoo, with that low humming noise. And so the Tesla tower creates a frequency, a low frequency humming, very similar to that. That's why it is heard all over the place for a long distance. So at any rate, what happens is the Tesla tower goes positive, maybe let's say 5 million volts, and then it goes negative 5 million volts. And positive 5 million volts, negative 5 million volts, it's an oscillating, it's basically a transformer, kicked up from a smaller voltage by a reverse transformer. So anyway, and it does this in about a 40 cycle per second frequency. And what the tower does is it starts to ionize, it starts to flip the dipoles in the atmospheric molecules. It starts flipping them in unison at that 40 cycle rate. Positive up, positive down. Positive up, positive down. And so the molecules in the atmosphere start flipping with the Tesla tower as the Tesla tower goes through its 40 cycle per second oscillation from 5 million volts positive to 5 million volts negative. Okay, now what happens? As you start tunneling upwards through the atmosphere, you start to drill an electric hole through the atmosphere vertically, and the atoms and molecules higher and higher up start flipping and flipping in unison, in unison. Okay, what are you doing? You're breaking down the dielectric, and it's just like if you took a drill in a capacitor and drilled a hole through the dielectric. What's going to happen? All of a sudden, that capacitor, which has been stored up to peak capacitance, the current will be able to flow through that hole from one capacitor plate to the other, and that's what you're doing. The ionosphere is a capacitor relative to ground. So the Tesla tower is nothing more than electrical drill drilling through the atmosphere, and once you get up to the ionosphere, you've drilled that far, and this is where it takes a lot of power. An antenna to kick out that kind of power, it takes a lot of power. And so the little experiment that the PSYOPs guys set up in the middle of the night up in Ottawa back in after my Tesla, Atlantis to Tesla book came out, they didn't understand something. First of all, they didn't understand how much power it was going to take. So this happened for a number of nights, and they realized they needed more power. So they got permission to hook the United States Northeast power grid that was powered by nuclear power reactors. They got permission to allow an overabundance of current to flow into the Ottawa grid to power that Tesla tower. Okay, now we have the grids connected with free permission to cross the power into Canada and open the diodes so that the power was free to flow northwards into the Ottawa grid. Now they had enough power to power up their Tesla tower, but there was only one little problem. When that baby cut loose, it unloaded the ionosphere, came down through that Tesla tower into the Northeast power grid with enough current to back up 9 nuclear reactors on the east coast of the United States. There was so much current running through the power grid that it burned out all kinds of equipment in homes. It burned out the EMF, burned out all types of parts in automobiles. It was an amazing amount of power surge backing up the current in 9 nuclear reactors. Now, folks, we're talking about an immense amount of power. And after further investigation, the U.S. Regulatory Commission came out and said it was because a squirrel's tail fell across a power cord in eastern Indiana. That was the official story. A squirrel's tail fell across a power line in Indiana, which triggered off a series of events that finally caused the Northeast power outage. That is so absurd. That's about as realistic as Comet Lovejoy going through the solar atmosphere and being a little snowball and coming out the other side and being bigger on the other side of the sun than when it went in. Well, the science today just doesn't get any more silly than this. Okay, so at any rate, I really wanted to talk about this because we're going back to the issue of Ottawa and the drumming noise. Now, I want to mention that some private investigations have narrowed down the source of the drumming to about a 1 square kilometer region, an industrial region in Windsor, just across the river from Detroit in Canada. So at any rate, it's been narrowed down to a small region where the drumming noise is coming from in a small industrialized zone of Windsor, Canada. So at any rate, possibly more on that. But I don't think that the noise around the world is the being caused by Tesla towers. I want to mention that. I believe it's being caused by, my personal thought, it's either by someone playing with one of the instruments there, one of the things we've given, paid for, the mill boys, and it's their new toy to play with and play games with the public, or it's natural. And so I haven't been able to determine what the possibilities are. Given that the sun is at a very low ebb and there's no solar conditions, there are no electrical solar conditions around us. I've been watching the sun and all the solar conditions recently. There's really not a lot going on out there. I would tend to say it's not the natural event. I would say somebody is playing with one of the toys that they've built on public funds, and that is the cause of the noise. And, of course, the people are saying that this is very distracting, very irritating. And I think that's the point, because once things start to go down, I think these are psychological experiments that are being played on the public. That's my personal view. I should also mention that Velikovsky, in his books, talks about the rumbling Earth. It's the Earth after the Venus event. The Earth went through rumbling stages for hundreds of years where the Earth was adjusting, and down deep the Earth was basically settling and readjusting. So the ancients talked about the rumbling Earth, and of course now we don't hear that too much anymore, but there are people that every now and then say, woof, there's some noises coming out of the Earth, rumbling noises, things going on down there. But that's due to the fact that Earth had a pretty good shaking here within the last 10,000 years, possibly a few good shakings. Oh, okay. Here's, as long as we're talking about this kind of thing, the quacks are at it again. The saw in a release somebody sending out emails. Somebody make one of the standard quacks making a claim that a Jupiter-sized object has been claimed with a family of comets surrounding it. You would almost think it was me talking if it's a family of comets, because most of the Planet X nut cases want you to think that it's a big round ball. But it's, they're saying it's a Jupiter-sized brown dwarf surrounded by comets. Well, why wouldn't the nucleus brown dwarf be a comet, too? That, I mean, right there, you know it's a quack talking. But I want to specifically name these people on the air because, for example, these are people that also drummed up the Comet Elenin thing. And repeatedly then they said that was Planet X. This is the same crew of nutcases, a guy named DiNardo. Just a quack nutcase. I talked with another talk show host recently who offered to interview some of these people, and they've refused to be on the air because they know they don't have any information. When somebody comes out and makes a claim to have information about Planet X, of course, the first question is, where is it? Where's the proof? Okay, somebody has observed this, and apparently with enough information to distinguish it as something not belonging to our solar system, where is that real information so it can be corroborated? And, of course, they don't have any. They've never had any because they're sitting in grandma's basement playing with their finger up their nose. And these are delusionary people. And this is a term that I'm glad this other talk show host used this term. And so that's what I'm going to use. And I think it's a great term. Delusionary people. And they think that they're going to help people by getting the word out there. There's quite a few of these people running around the internet. Many of them started as followers of mine and then broke off when I denounced their goofiness, their ridiculous ploys, playing weird space music, and some of them trying to use my information to tell you that Planet X is in the solar system now. And dozens and dozens of times repeating or coming up with new claims, you know, this is for sure now, you know, and so what does it do? It turns people off. So I had a few bouts of email sessions with some people this week who said, look, if Planet is here, somebody should be able to tell where it is. And that's really, in a sense, true to the person who doesn't know the story. But so what do the idiots do? They turn people off. They're not helping anybody. The people that make false, ridiculous claims on the internet. And of course, if you look beneath the scenes, you would either have to make one of two claims. These people are delusionary idiots that it's almost like some kind of cult religion for them, that every week they have to be saying that Planet X is here, it's behind the sun, or why can't we see it? You know, 30 reasons to one why you can't see Planet X, even though they claim that they have data about it. Okay, so at any rate, what's the real story on discovering Planet X? And so I've gone through this many times on my radio show, but for the benefit of a lot of people out there, here's the real situation. When major league big objects come into the solar system, as they're far out there, sure, they're going to have a little solar system of their own surrounding them as they've accumulated big objects as they've moved through outer space by capture. They have basically a solar system just like our own solar system. It might be a mini solar system. I should mention that Comet Lovejoy had a moon around it. It had a moon that preceded it as it came in to the sun. There was a small comet that was a moon of Comet Lovejoy. So this is not unusual. Comet Hale-Bopp had a moon surrounding it. So a large comet very likely would have many comets. And the ancients talk about this. They talk about multiple comets in the sky at one time. But here's what happens when a very large object starts to break into the very, very far regions of the solar system. This is way out beyond Pluto, maybe one or two Pluto distances from the sun. So these objects still would be at the very, very faintest possible location for discovery. And one would have to have specialized equipment to see them at that point. As these objects start to break through the solar capacitor at that point, the nebular cloud out there, they start to discharge the solar capacitor on a local basis out there, and they start to draw in nitrogen. They start to draw in oxygen and dust that's accumulated and held back out there by solar wind pressure. So basically, here's what happens. They start to form a shroud, a shroud of dust and gas around them, and it basically blocks the sun from hitting the nucleus. So it shields them. It's like an umbrella shielding them from the little bit of solar light. Now, remember that the sun at that distance almost looks like just another star. The sun we see in the sky, you think it's big and bright, but go out two Pluto distances from the sun, and you're just looking at another star. So there's really not a lot of sunlight out there. And when it starts, the shroud starts to form around these big objects, they're even harder to see. So NASA has designed, and this is based on information, of course, that they've learned from me, NASA has designed spacecraft telescopes that are in outer space functioning, searching for these large infrared, in the infrared, in the deep infrared, very cold clouds. And they're from visible from Earth, they're about the size of the full moon, but extremely faint and moving very slowly. So you can see now that the average amateur astronomer isn't going to see this. They're not going to see these things until they're way into the solar system. And then all of a sudden they break into a large comet, and then it's a question of what part of the solar system they are in. I referred to Comet Lovejoy. Comet Lovejoy made it all the way to the sun without anybody noticing it. Did NASA notice it? I bet they did, but they just didn't say anything. It was discovered by an amateur in southern Australia. It came out of the southern sky, a part of the southern sky that is only visible during a very brief period of the year, and it's only visible if you have good equipment down in Antarctica. And I've been through this many times before. So, number one question, would amateurs be able to see it? No. The vast majority of amateurs are not at the South Pole. They don't have equipment there. They don't have a way to get equipment there or monitor in that region. So the vast majority of amateur astronomers are not going to see anything from there, and that's where all of these comets seem to be coming from. That's why NASA has built facilities there. That's why the Vatican has built facilities there. That's why other countries have built astronomical facilities there. They haven't built any at the North Pole. Gee, I wonder why. So at any rate, number two, you need specialized equipment. Your average backyard telescope ain't gonna cut it. The comet Lovejoy, the guy that discovered that comet, has backyard equipment. But he didn't discover it until it was very, very near the sun, and it was very major in size at that point, easily discovered by amateur equipment, and it had finally skirted its way in to where it was near the sun, and that's when he discovered it. Hours before, as you heard on the video at the beginning, only 15 hours before it came in and hit the sun. That's when he discovered it, just hours before it got to the sun. So this comet, one of the biggest comets to come into the solar system in history, made it all the way to the sun and nobody saw it. Or do you think NASA saw it? I do. I know they saw it. How could they not see it? They'd have to be a bunch of complete buffoons. Well, they are, but no, they have equipment. They can see those things, and they have all the equipment at the South Pole. So, no, absolutely, and they have spaceborne equipment, which doesn't depend on being at the South Pole. They can see it from the darkness of space. They can see it any time of day. So, sure, NASA saw it coming, but they never said anything. That proves also that NASA will not tell you if they see something coming. So, at any rate, a lot of details about Planet X. So, remember that a lot of the misinformation, the nutcases that are out there drumming Planet X, I liken them to people that are being used probably by programs. It's very similar to, what would you say, a lot of the other programs where the misinformation crew gets a hold of people and uses them. They're very usable because they're very needy people. They're people that have very delicate personalities, very ego-needy, so they have to be out in the public. How can somebody make repeated claims that Comet Elenin is Planet X and now a Jupiter-sized object discovered with it, it's Planet X, and that have not any information repeatedly, month after month, coming out with pure garbage that is in between? I remember these nutcases a few years ago. Oh, it's almost to Earth. It's going to hit Earth next month. You know, it's just, and then they're wrong, and then they keep going on, and next month they come out with another new claim. But the other thing it does is it turns a lot of people away, and therein, I think, lies the point. Misinformation is one of the biggest tools of the people that control the world to dissuade the idea of Planet X. Planet X is a very complex topic. I suggest that you, if you want more information on that, get my new two CD set. I've got some very extensive lecture series on Planet X and the psychology of Planet X. Very important, the psychology of Planet X, a four-hour lecture series included in that 18 hours of lectures on that CD set. By the way, I'm just going to go back to what I started with. A lot of this information on my radio show, remember that you are only going to hear it here. You're not going to hear this on the major daytime talk show hosts. They won't cover these topics. So I want to return to the idea that I'm having a book sale, and I want people to go out. It's a good time to help out. And it won't take long, and I suspect that my two-for-one sale will end probably sometime this week. So, but anybody that's out there that does want to help, if you have an extra set of books to give to some students, I talked about one of the fans buying books for a student, etc. But at any rate, go to the webpage, any book, CD, DVD, or set thereof, you get two-for-one. And if your order for including anything, including water filters, products, etc., if your order is more than $400 total, then that includes any of the items, then you get a free Kato WRX 911 emergency shortwave FM AM radio sent to you free. So at any rate, and like I say, this is a good cause. It helps offset the cost of the printing of those three books, the Planet X, Comets, and Earth Changes book, the ATL, the Atlantis to Tesla, and then the Calculate Primes book. And I'm out of time. This is Jim McCanny. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.